Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today a local Austin attorney, Carlos Soltero, who I happen to know well from being in and around Austin and through the Austin Bar and other ways. Carlos, welcome to the show.
Thank y'all for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You are, I believe, the first really trial lawyer focused or trial work focused attorney we've had on the show. We had Reagan Simpson on pretty recently, and Reagan's done his share of trial work over the years, more than his share. And we've had some who've, you know, dabbled in trial court work here and there, or maybe earlier in their careers, but I don't think we've had anyone quite in your position, because I know you as a lawyer, I know you primarily as a trial lawyer. And we want to talk to you about your practice generally. We're going to talk about the main issue that we want to cover today is trial lawyers who handle their own appeals, because I happen to know that you do a fair amount of that and have had quite a bit of success with that. But just so we kind of set the stage here, how about you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, where you come from, your background, and I guess maybe we can talk about where you went to school, because you're going to make us all feel inferior when you talk about that.
I don't know about any of that, but I'll tell you, I think without trial lawyers, you appellate lawyers wouldn't have so much to write about. And so I'm glad that you finally included us and invited us in your great podcast series. I'm currently, as you know, at my firm, Soltero Sapphire Merle. I have been practicing in Austin for about 20 years. Before that, I practiced in Houston at a variety of firms. I started out at Vinson & Elkins for a short period of time, was at Smizer Kaplan, and then moved over here. Was in Austin, started out at McGinnis Lockridge, was there about 17 years or so, and then went to Cleveland Terrazas before starting this firm. I went to law school at Yale. I grew up mostly in the Houston area, but I was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico. My mom's family is from the border, Eagle Pass.
Now, I didn't know about the Puerto Rico connection, because I thought your family was from the Valley.
No, well, my mom's family is, it's not the Valley, it's from Eagle Pass.
Right.
But it is border town. And literally, when I grew up going there all the time as a child, we would walk over across the border, even as young children, just like you would cross a neighborhood here or something. Different times, wouldn't do that now. But yeah, my dad is Puerto Rican, and I was born in Puerto Rico. I was there till I was six. I often say, sometimes you'll hear me say this in some kind of a deposition or something, but Spanish is my first language, so English is my second language. And sometimes when witnesses don't understand my question, maybe it's because of the language barrier.
I thought you were going to tell me that you'll take depositions in Spanish.
No, we'll not do that. But it's sometimes helpful to hear both the witness in Spanish and the interpretation. Most of the time, the interpreters do a really good job doing something very difficult. Occasionally, there are material differences. One time that stands out in my mind was that the translated version was gun, but the witness said shotgun. So I clarified that, because that can be a slightly different detail that happened to matter in that particular circumstance.
What a nice skill to have in our part of the country and as a litigator. I mean, I can only imagine. I'm jealous, because I can barely string together two sentences in English, my first language. But no, that's awesome. So you are been at some great firms and done a lot of interesting things. But one thing I happen to know about you is you're a board certified in personal injury law. And what led you to get that certification?
But I started out in the tort section at B&E, and then when I left to Smizer Kaplan, they had just opened their firm, and they had a fairly healthy docket of mostly plaintiff side personal injury cases, in addition to the med mal defense work that they had excellent hospital and other med mal clients. And so those kind of cases in the mid 90s were still being tried regularly. And so was fortunate enough to have had a lot of trial experience, first chair and otherwise. Not only with them, but then when I was over at McGinnis, I was still trying cases fairly regularly. I tried to get at least one or so a year. And so I was at some point eligible for the board certification in personal injury. That's been a big part of my practice, differing degrees at different times, but it's still been an important part of the practice for some time. I don't do that predominantly, or it's not an overwhelming part of my practice, but it's something that I consistently have done.
What are you focusing on now as far as the kinds of cases that you're handling as a trial lawyer?
It really does vary from time. I've found a cluster of different things throughout time. To answer your question directly, right now I'm still doing a lot of trade secret, employment, non-compete things. I still have a selective amount of personal injury work. As I like to say, people fighting over money, civil litigation of different types. But, you know, at times I found that some issues get more and more traction. I'm sure y'all have found that too, and some of the other folks who practice. And like, for instance, for a while, I had kind of a lot of international type cases just because that happened to be coming up a lot. Other times, some other types of financial cases or whatever are more prevalent. But right now, it's just the non-compete and general mix.
Where do you find most of your cases come from? Are you getting a lot of work through referrals? Or I don't see your firm advertising on billboards. So, you know, and that's obviously not the kind of practice that you're focusing on these days. But where does most of the work come from?
Overwhelmingly referrals, people who we've worked with in the past, who we know, who trust us, we trust them, who know us, family members, and just word of mouth more than anything. We have also a great group of sort of repeat clients and some institutional that we've done work for years. And fortunately for us, they keep calling us.
I think appellate lawyers, it's pretty common to have sort of the same arrangement. It's mostly, you know, relationships with other people. And for me, and I think for Jody too, the relationships with trial lawyers. But I'm always interested in how trial lawyers get their work, because ours really is so dependent on, you know, those direct relationships with people. So
I think that's the key in our business for a lot of us. And whether I know a lot of people have, for instance, corporate lawyers or other people that routinely they have common clients and interests and that sort of thing. I think it just depends. But we are overwhelmingly, I think, still a relationship service business.
Having those repeat clients is always good if they're involved in litigation on a regular basis. That's something that we don't tend to see quite as often, unless you're in an area like insurance and you're handling a certain kind of docket for a certain company. But yeah, that's really great to hear. You've certainly done a good job of making yourself visible in the legal community. You know, one other way, there's about half a dozen different ways that I know you, but one other way that I know you is through some of those activities, like working on the pattern jury charge committee, which is something we can talk about. And then you and I also sit on the JCIT, the Judicial Committee for Information Technology, together. I love the PJC stuff, but I've not been involved in it nearly as long as you have. In fact, you're the vice chair of the business and insurance book, the Blue Book. How did you first get involved in that, and what would you want to tell listeners about it?
Well, I'll start answering that in reverse order. What I'd like to tell listeners is it's a great group, always has been, and it's a lot of appellate lawyers, very thoughtful people, very thoughtful debate. Sometimes it can be like a law review where it's minutia and commas and things of that nature. And sometimes it's serious, substantive, you know, what does this mean in the law, jurisprudential type discussions. How I got involved initially, because now serving with you, Todd, it's my second tour of duty, so to speak, on the volume. And I think they had enough of me for a while. I was off, I was doing other things, and then I came back, fortunately. But I don't remember who first nominated me or how I first got on there, but I was on there for quite a while. And it was a huge learning experience. It was great to be around, to hear different perspectives from both practitioners, mostly, like I said, appellate lawyers, but also trial lawyers, as well as judges at both levels, and how all kinds of things that we kind of would, I think, take for granted or just assume they are a certain way, how you hear, wow, well, I can't believe that that's how that might be perceived or come out. And so, and then, of course, keeping up with all the cases, the updates, and making sure that the PJC that we're putting out as a book product is faithful to what the opinions say, what the law is, to the best of our ability. And we've had, like, the one example that comes to mind is at one time back, this was the first tour of duty, the tortious interference with prospective relations, an opinion came out from the Supreme Court basically saying we'd gotten it wrong. And so, you know, time to change it. No question about it. So it's a great group.
That doesn't happen very often, that the committee kind of got its marching orders. And believe it was that the Don Willett opinion that said, yeah, this all looks fine, but it's really not correct.
The one I think of is, if I remember right, Walmart versus Sturgis goes back a ways. It was way back when. We've had others where the law has certainly been different than what we thought it was or clarified.
I imagine in the business and insurance context in particular, it's one of those areas that continues to rapidly develop in Texas practice. So I'm sure that y'all have your hands full every couple of years trying to keep track of all the things that have changed.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jody. And I'll tell you that, for instance, the volume when I first was on it was a really thin, relatively thin, easy to bring around kind of book. And now it's like, it's a huge doorstop. We've added defamation and invasion of privacy, the privacy torts and trade secrets. But I'm always impressed with the level of effort and thoughtfulness that goes into it.
I'll tell you, when I'm working on an issue that I know is in the PJC these days, especially our book, it's really gotten to be a really good resource. I mean, it's not a law review article. It's not intended to be, but if you want to see, be steered to the principal authorities on a certain issue, especially Supreme Court authorities, it's actually a good place to start in terms of research.
Well, and I think people overlook the comments to their detriment too, because there really is a lot of super helpful information in there that kind of gives you the off the beaten path ways of submitting things that people don't often think of, because it's so easy to get a proposed charge where somebody just quotes the PJC, but you miss a lot of the nuances that come up if you're not reading beyond that of, here's some things to think about.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I'll tell you that we spend, and Todd can also probably attest to this, while we do occasionally make changes, what we call above the line, what you're referring to, that people cut and paste and put into whatever charge they're submitting. But most of the editing and work and arguments take place in what you're talking about, the comment section that we call below the line. Again, it's pretty typically tends to be pretty thoughtful and after a lot of vetting before it gets put in there. Don't you think, Todd?
I totally agree.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
I've learned a lot just in going through the last couple of years of being on the committee. And I'll also go ahead and mention that we're in a publication year now, and the new book is about to come out. And of course, in my opinion, there are parts of it that are outdated, even as it's being released. That's the problem you have with a periodically released publication. You're always going to have new authorities that have to be factored in. So it's interesting. We get a lot of support from the state bar staff. They're great working with us. They keep us in line and keep us on track. And it's been a wonderful experience for me. And really, as you've pointed out, some really impressive folks who have worked on that committee. And I know the same is true for the others as well. Talk for just a minute, though, I mentioned the JCIT, because that's been a really busy committee for several years now. I mean, that's the committee that Texas lawyers have to thank for the e-filing system that's now in place and making that rolled out, administering and implementing the Supreme Court's mandate that electronic filing be mandatory. And it's one thing about that committee that's been interesting is watching how, yes, the mandatory rule came out, but it was kind of phased in, and we're supporting even the most rural counties in the state in getting e-filing in place, not only on the civil side, but also on the criminal side.
Yeah, I'll tell you that I think during the pandemic, one of the many things that I'll say is that the Office of Court Administration and the people who work there and what they've done is incredible and amazing in order to keep our profession working as well as it has with all the challenges with the remote hearings, et cetera. And yeah, I mean, JCIT, before the pandemic, much of our effort went into the e-filing, the new Research Texas sort of PACER-like system that has been implemented, and I found it to be quite useful. Again, this is another place where you get input from all sectors of the state, all different levels, and it very informed and smart and talented people come together And it turns out to be a pretty good product. It's been my very good decision making, but certainly learned a lot about filing, about the number of court systems we have, the respective course in 254 counties, each with a clerk, multiple clerks, and everything else that's involved with that has been really a fascinating, something that they don't teach you enough about in law school. You probably hear me from time to time as an old guy, I say, hey, they really should tell you these things in law school. And really, that's one of them, is the important function of the clerks and how in Texas, those are important elected positions and how different everything, court records and things of that nature that I think most practitioners just take for granted. We just file stuff and don't really think about it.
We were visiting last week with folks that run an appellate law podcast in Oklahoma. We learned, much to our surprise, that they don't even have e-filing at all in Oklahoma.
All paper.
And I'll tell you, the level that we're operating in our state with mandatory e-filing and spreading it clear across the state and all jurisdictions, all court levels and all practice areas, it is quite a job to roll that out.
And we were lucky that that had been in the works for as long as it had, you know, David Slayton, everybody else over there and everything that had been, like I said, had been rolled out for so many years that it, I think it all helped the state continue relatively as smooth as possible during this pandemic.
That's absolutely right. I mean, from the user perspective, it was really a seamless transition with regard to day-to-day operations because you could still get everything online until the ransomware shut down the courts of appeals. But it's amazing to think about all the back-end work that went into and still goes into that every day just to keep that system going.
Absolutely. Well, I don't want to let it go by. I want to ask you a little bit about the book you wrote. I've seen it in some of your biographical materials, although I can't recall the name of it. What's the title?
Sure. It's called Latinos and American Law.
What prompted you to research and write on that topic? I mean, obviously, you've got your cultural heritage, but I mean, it's a fascinating topic, of course. But you go from trial lawyer by day to author, quite a meaty topic.
We got to have something to do in the middle of the night. Now, so what happened is that when I was a third year in law school, I was able to teach a course at the undergraduate, a semester seminar on the topic on how the legal system, different ways in which the legal system has affected Hispanic, Latino, Mexican-American, et cetera, communities and individuals in different ways that are significant. And it was a college level course. It was, I think, pretty good feedback. I think everybody said I assigned too much reading. But other than that, I thought people enjoyed it. And so sometime later, I thought it'd be a good idea to try to put that together in a, and again, a sort of a college level. It's not a case law book in the sense that you would have in law school or at that level. It's also not, I think really it's targeted to sort of people who, again, kind of a college level audience on what are the sort of the greatest hits in a way, in my own perspective of some of these. And some of them refer to, like, one of my favorites that I like to talk about is Balzac versus Puerto Rico, B-A-L-Z-A-C. He was a publisher of a newspaper called El Baluarte. And he actually, it's very similar to John Peter Zenger, which many people know about from colonial times, who was criticizing the colonial governor appointed by the crown. And he was, I believe, in New York or Pennsylvania. And Mr. Balzac was criticizing the American appointed colonial governor in Puerto Rico. He did not get a jury like Mr. Zenger did, even though he said, we're American citizens. We have a right to a jury trial under the Sixth Amendment and a First Amendment right to criticize the government's position on whatever it was he was writing about. But the unanimous Supreme Court, certainly surprising to us today, but perhaps not surprising if you know some of the history, concluded that the Sixth Amendment and frankly, the First Amendment did not automatically apply in the territories. And certainly the Sixth Amendment to this day has not been fully applied, even though there are jury trials in Puerto Rico. But it was not a constitutionally guaranteed automatic thing as some of the judges on the other side of that debate at one point would have contended. So it's a really fascinating case. There's that one. There's the school district finance case, San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez. And so I just wanted to highlight, again, different cases, all U.S. Supreme Court cases that reach that level that really have a little different impact on a substantial number of people in the United States.
That's really cool. Do you teach a class on that from time to time?
I have taught it previously. It's been years. I've been, as Todd pointed out, been practicing law a lot.
Gets in the way.
This gets in the way. We're trying to raise some children and do some other things. So that maybe I'll get back to teaching sometime. I really enjoy it. I think it's nice to be able to get back in that way.
That really is fascinating. Now, I want to dive into the topic that really I had in mind when I asked you to come on the show. And You know, we mentioned that you're a trial lawyer primarily. I mean, we haven't explored trial practice much other than how we talk on here a lot about how appellate lawyers can help trial lawyers make their practices better and represent their clients, you know, be efficient and focus in on some key issues in the case. But, you know, as I think I mentioned, I happen to know that you're a trial lawyer who has handled a whole lot of his own appeals. And so I guess the question I'll start with is, as a trial lawyer, you know, what is your view of appellate counsel? I mean, give us the skinny from your side of the desk here, because we haven't gotten to hear this very much.
Needless to say, I'm not speaking on behalf of the tens of thousands of trial lawyers across the state and everybody who's got their own view on things, okay? Because I'm sure there's a wide variety of different views. But I mean, from my perspective, I've always found appellate counsel to be super valuable and important. Like you said, I have done my own appeals, but not always. And I mean, I think one of the things that I've noticed, and I frequently team up with other appellate lawyers, or what I found has happened more in recent years, is I've seen general counsel in-house, and I've seen other clients also do this, which is to kind of put together, cobble together a team that's right for them and for that particular case. I really like that view and approach. I like to work with other people. I like to joint venture. I like to collaborate, not just with my partners and people at my firm, but at other places. I think that can really add value. In terms of how I view appellate counsel, like I said, other than when they always want to criticize me for all the things I should have done but didn't do at the time, which I understand is largely the job of appellate lawyers. I know for years of practice that many times we get appellate lawyers involved early on to help with the charge, with summary judgment. Certainly, I think the Daubert Robinson case law is fairly well developed, but when that was kind of developing, I think that was another place where appellate lawyers were instrumental in helping guide trial lawyers to get the kind of record you want. So I think if in an ideal world, you would want to get an appellate lawyer involved as soon as you get your pleadings lined up and everything, and have them kind of periodically kind of jump in at the right times to help to make sure that the case is going on the track that we want it to go. And that way, you know, on appeal, you can share the decision-making responsibility, you know, rather than, because I know sometimes y'all just get called for the first time after there's been a verdict or a judgment, and getting to know, well, what happened here? How did we get here? All these things happened is a lot of time and effort, and it takes a lot of to ramp up to really get to know a case, giving y'all the opportunity to jump in earlier. If a client asked me, would always be my preferred approach, but sometimes that can't happen.
No disagreement.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, gosh, okay. That answer, I'm pleasantly surprised at how you answered that question, because that would be an answer I would want any trial lawyer to give instead of the appellate lawyers just tooting their own horns all the time.
Which we do most episodes.
We do a little bit. It's not completely shameless, but no, that I'm pleasantly surprised that answer. And I guess the reason why I was thinking about you from a standpoint of a trial lawyer who handles his own appeals is because I know you had a really significant case that went up and down in the Fifth Circuit a couple of times a few years ago. And you used to tell me about it from time to time. And I mean, you're one of the few people that I know who's actually had an en banc argument at the Fifth Circuit. Is that right?
Yes. Well, yeah. And that was a series of cases, really, really interesting. My opponents, very able counsel, primarily from California, but also some here in Texas, on a particular ERISA type of cases. And both sides were very, I guess, committed to the fight. And so, yeah, I think I went to argue in the Fifth Circuit four times in those two cases, including an en banc argument, which was great experience. I haven't had the opportunity or pleasure of arguing before the Texas Supreme Court yet. But I suspect it's a bit similar, except there's just so many of them during the en banc. I remember that the greatest mercy that Judge Owen gave me I could tell that Judge Owen was asking a question and I could hear her and I knew the question. I knew who was asking, but I couldn't find her in the sort of, you know, placement of everybody. And one of the other judges, thankfully and mercifully, made a gesture to point to where she was. And that was quite helpful. But yeah, that was a great experience and opportunity. And I was very happy to be able to do that. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoy, I mean, I appreciate and admire a lot what I'd call real appellate lawyers like y'all do, which y'all do regularly. I enjoy it too. I think it's an interesting to be able to dive into the record, get the salient parts, try to lay it out in the best way you can, and then present it in a way that's meaningful to judges and others who have already read through the record and typically have very specific targeted questions that they're asking us as lawyers to do what we can do best, which is help the court and the clients, of course.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. I'll just go out and say that you've got the mindset of an appellate lawyer. All of your comments today, you're definitely, I swear, Jody, I didn't coach him on the things to say. I mean, you're touching all the bases. I mean, you're talking about things that we've talked about here on the show a lot, as far as the skill set it takes and the ability to focus in on the things that are likely to be important to the court. You know, one thing that seems like it's difficult if you're going to handle your own appeals is sort of divorcing your mind from your perception of what happened at trial to sort of take a step back, sort of a 30,000 foot approach to the issues in the case. Do you have any suggestions for other trial lawyers who, you know, would want to handle their own appeals? How do you go about that yourself?
I think I would say that it does happen that the way you remember something is not necessarily the way it looks on the appellate record. I will tell you that. Either because the demeanor of a witness, or because I'm sure that came up, but then you can't find it somewhere, can be very frustrating. And it can be hard when you're doing kind of the second or third go round of what you had done before, not necessarily being able to, you know, having that preconceived notion of, no, I was there, I can tell you what happened. And also, because things get, appellate lawyers go back and forth skillfully and criticize each other's writings and positions and things of that nature, but sometimes it can get kind of chippy at the trial court, and sometimes that can be difficult too, is working through how you viewed something, and then again seeing it on a cold record can be different. So in terms of advice for a trial lawyer handling their own appeal, the best thing that I can think to do is to try to take it over, and like the way y'all do, which is not walk into it thinking, okay, this is what we need to do, but rather, okay, what's the issue in the case? What happened? What does the record actually say? I mean, it's hard.
One of the things that I've always thought was a hard part of trial work is kind of wearing two hats. Well, on the one hand, your focus is winning the case and making sure that your strategy is focused on that, but at the same time, making sure that you're making the best record that you can. That's a tough thing to do. How do you walk that line? And do you find, having done a lot of appeals, that influences the way that you do both of those things?
Having done appeals makes me a better trial lawyer. Having tried cases, I think, may help me contribute better on appeal. But I will say that the short answer is it depends, but absolutely. I mean, I think many times you can be the night before, like the middle of trial, and some issue comes up and we have a very heart-to-heart discussion with a client about it and say, look, there's kind of two different things going on here. One is we got to preserve the record, but, you know, are you going to antagonize the judge by doing this? Are we going to do something which the jury's going to perceive, if it's a jury trial, the jury's going to perceive as you're obstructing the coming of truth or whatever, the discovery of truth. And so you just have to make those calls as best you can. I think I found, certainly in Texas, and I've been involved in some trials outside of Texas, but in Texas, most trial judges have the right attitude and demeanor about these things, and don't try to make it any harder for you to preserve error on appeal. There's maybe some exceptions, but overall, the judges will accommodate you when you let them know that this is an issue and I think, you know, we may have to take it up on appeal. They'll find a way to do it outside the presence of the jury, or they'll give you opportunities to preserve your record, particularly if you're straightforward with them and not just spring it on them unexpectedly or tell them it's going to be this long, but then you string it out with some kind of attempt to make objections on the record, et cetera. Plus, and the jury charge is the other part where it's hugely important. Everybody says, I would be lying if I said every case I always have a jury charge at the beginning. That doesn't happen. But I'll say that in every complex case, I tend to do a jury charge pretty early on and have that inform discovery and depositions and motions. I mean, to carry that through, I think it's much harder to just put the charge together at the end, 30 days before trial, and you can avoid some difficulties by doing it ahead of time.
When you try cases as lead counsel, and if you've worked up the jury charge, Do you find it hard to make that change between, you know, arguing the charge, making your charge objections, and then going right into your closing? Because that's always, in my observation, I've always viewed that as being a really great place to have someone, you know, not involved in examining witnesses and necessarily making the jury argument come in, because your mind has got to be, all right, here's, I'm about to go give the most important speech of the week to the jury, but yet I've got to make sure I preserve these objections. I mean, you may be a little different than a lot of lawyers, Carlos, just because you've got the experience of now having served two terms on the PJC committee. And we talk a lot in that committee about error preservation. And so I'll tell you, one of the reasons why I got involved in that committee is because I wanted to get better at doing jury charge work. And what's your experience with that?
Yeah. So what I'd say on that is I have tried a case 100% by myself, probably maybe more than one. There's one that comes to mind in Fort Bend County, but typically that's a rare situation. I mean, most of the time I'll be trying a case as part of a team. And so to me, some of the charge issue is a task to be assigned ahead of time as to whether I'm going to be taking the lead on it or somebody else. And so we factor that when we decide, okay, well, hey, you're going to have to take this witness or this expert or this whatever, because I'm going to be dealing with a charge or what have you, or I'll do that. And somebody else will deal with the charge, at least either the informal charge conference or, you know, anything that may come up along those lines. But I mean, it's just kind of, I look at it in some ways like settlement. Like if I'm trying the case, if I'm either the lead lawyer or the primary lawyer trying the case, I don't want to talk settlement. I'm just not interested. It's a total distraction. Somebody else can do that, whether it's an in-house counsel or another lawyer on the file. And so I think of the charge similarly. That's a discrete task if you've got the luxury of having more than one attorney, which we typically do. But if you got any tips, I'll take them from either one of y'all, Jody or Todd.
I mean, I think you're doing it the right way. Trying to juggle it is so hard because it's very easy, especially when you have one of those cases where the charge has been a work in progress and then the judge passes out a copy of it and says, okay, everybody take 30 minutes and then come back and make your objections. If you're doing that at the same time you're trying to write your closing, I mean, that's just such a hard thing to try and balance all those different roles at one time.
I think the theme that I'm hearing is really coming from you is collaboration. Mm-hmm. You certainly have the capacity to do good work in preparing a brief and arguing a case from the appellate side, but it would be a whole different deal for me to go and say, I'm going to suddenly start taking depositions and, you know, I'm sure I'd go argue motions in the trial court. That's not a problem. But most of the fact witness and the expert witness stuff is a little hard to go back to that after doing what I've been doing for a really long time, which is really the legal issue work. The collaboration theme is, you know, it sounds like given the choice, if you've got the right circumstances, the right case, the right client, that you can sort of, I hate to say compartmentalize, but that's a word that comes to mind. Some of these sort of discrete tasks where you can really be efficient and focus on like somebody who's going to take the fact witnesses, who's going to take the expert witnesses. You might divvy that up even further, I suppose.
I think that's right. And sometimes, depending on the case, there can be, you can say, well, lawyer one will handle the claims coming at us, for lack of a better way to put it. Like in a business case where there's typically claims going both directions, or it's not as important who the plaintiff is in many cases. You can compartmentalize them, witnesses that are primarily on the counterclaims, for instance, versus on our claims, or you can divide it by damages. I think there's a way to do that. And the other thing, and I know, Todd, we've talked about this a lot through the years, you and I, attorney's fees is another area where I think this is important, because I had a case that I tried by Zoom for not three entire weeks, but over the course of 3 weeks for a good, it was, I don't know how many, maybe 7 or 8 trial days, whatever it was. And I had the luxury of having co-counsel for a different client who did a lot of the heavy lifting on a lot of the things. So I was the only lawyer for my client in most of these things. But as we were getting ready towards the end and the attorney's fees issue were coming up, I wanted to bring in one of the other lawyers at my office to present me on attorney's fees, because I know you can do that in narrative format. And I've seen people do that very effectively. That's not how I prefer to do it.
I think that has to be harder now than it used to be. We just did a show on attorney's fees very recently. And so Jody and I have expounded on that topic quite a bit. In fact, you know, Carlos, you and I have talked about it in another context. And I just think with the kind of detail you got to go into, I mean, you can use your billing records to provide a lot of the detail, but it just seems that the way the courts are looking at these things now, it's more dangerous than it used to be to testify in a narrative form, because you've got to make sure, I guess, unless if you're going to get up there and basically read your outline, and you do the work ahead of time, then I suppose. But I've never testified in narrative form, and I wouldn't want to. I want someone else, you know, sort of directing the discussion. Talk about it ahead of time as far as what it's going to be. But I can't imagine that.
Well, like I said, I've seen it done very skillfully by people who are very good lawyers. But I'm like you in that regard. I prefer to have the question and answer traditional format and ideally at least have an idea of what the questions are going to be and make sure that all the sort of boxes are checked of what you need to do under the case law, in particular Rormus, which I'm sure y'all have talked about it. And everybody knows about it by now. I mean, it's such a important seminal opinion in the area of attorney's fees in Texas. And I always, as unanimous court, I can almost glean Judge Green on behalf of the court saying, hey, look, we've been telling you people that this is how we want you to do it. And you guys seem to not be getting the message. That's how I interpret that case. And it's very clear and a good roadmap. I think there's still some inconsistencies as to how attorney's fees are done throughout the state, but that's part of what keeps y'all and me in business is continuing to clarify the unresolved issues.
I think that's right. And I think Todd and I both agree with you. I think that's pretty much exactly what they were saying in Rormus is, hey, we meant it. It's Lodestar and here's how you do it and stop messing around with this other stuff.
Well, it wasn't quite as clear as the court had meant for it to be, I suppose, because there had been several different approaches taken still and different views from the courts of appeals. But you're right, Carlos. I mean, the Justice Green and the other eight members of the court made it crystal clear in Rormus how things were supposed to go going forward. And of course, as we have talked about between us and on the show, our recent episode, it's not quite as cut and dried when it comes to proving up the appellate fees. And we've covered this in detail. I don't want to necessarily tread a whole bunch of new ground, but one of the things that you and I have debated a little, mostly inside the four walls of the PJC, is how to submit attorney's fees in a jury charge. Because the current PJC, the way it reads, is you've got several blanks for different phases of an appeal. And I think now one thing that I think we're going to have to look at from the committee standpoint is what does the Yole versus Granite Operating Company case do to the way that prospective conditional appellate fees are submitted? Because what the court said that I think is going to make things more complicated is that it's not a strict Lodestar analysis. You have to make that prediction. So even though it does seem very similar to Lodestar, the standard is not exactly the same. And it's interesting to see. It's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. I'm certainly watching it very closely.
Yes. My two initial thoughts on that are, one, obviously the 2020 volume's coming out any day now, and it's going to be materially different. There's going to be a change in the attorney's fee section that's going to be important for people to take a look at, helping address issues of apportionment or sometimes called segregation and some other things, I think. But right, with you and I, Todd, respectfully disagree on the ideal way to submit conditional appellate fees to a jury. I mean, from my perspective, I do think it's not that different than lost profits in the future. We often present evidence to a jury as to what we think something would be in reasonable probability, and those support an award, a judgment, hopefully get it affirmed on appeal, et cetera. I see the appeal, and this is where people on the podcast are all going to hate me now, but I see the appellate lawyer appeal of having more and more blanks where juries can write numbers. And I respectfully understand that there are differences in terms of briefing when the petition is initially requested. If you're actually asked to respond to it, the full briefing on the merits argument, those different levels. But, you know, currently, and that's going to remain for a while, the way it's done, I just don't know that you couldn't collapse some of those, and especially in a case where there's multiple attorney's fees questions to a jury. And because of the nature of the proof, et cetera, I think that would be one where, as a trial lawyer, I would prefer less blanks rather than more, probably. But
that's where you reveal your true colors, Carlos, because we appellate lawyers, we want more blanks for fees. You're exactly right.
Well, I mean, on the plaintiff side, typically as a trial lawyer, I want plenty of blanks too. I mean, I want to give the jury an opportunity to correctly award damages as many times as possible. But I just think it parses it down so much. It, you know, to use jury charge language, it's granulating future appellate fees in a way that, again, can you do it that way? Sure. Is it the only way? No.
I'm curious your thoughts, Carlos, as a trial lawyer, about submitting attorney's fees to the jury versus the judge.
I think I have a lot of thoughts about that. And I don't have opinion. I have an opinion as much as thoughts. I mean, I think it depends. I think that juries don't like attorney's fees disputes. I mean, I think I think that's true. I think that judges don't like trying attorney's fees cases to the jury. I think that Of course, we have a constitution that rightly provides the right to trial by jury on tribal issues. And if there's a fact issue, that's who decides it in the absence of the contrary. Many times I've been able to reach stipulations with the other side on either rates, amounts, any number of things. And I think if you can do that, that's great. Many times you can't do that for a variety of reasons. And so in terms of jury versus bench, I think it takes longer to do it in front of a jury, just like any jury trial takes longer. And I mean, the judges get it right away and they just want to know the things that most lawyers look at. You know, what's the rate? What do you spend your time on, et cetera? With the juries, you get to tell more of a story, I think, about the case in addition to, and I've done it both ways. And also, obviously, the third way that we do it regularly in Texas is in federal court by post-judgment
Right. Declarations
and motion practice. All of those have pluses and minuses, I guess. I'd say that the federal ones can be, it's like doing appellate work, can be very detailed, more on like, well, let me just say this, then we can stop talking about attorney's fees. But even though it's near and dear to all of our hearts, I find in federal court and sometimes in the state court ones, if there's a serious briefing issue, looking at other awards of attorney's fees is like a big deal. I found that to be, you know, if you track down every fill in the blank, every DTPA case you can find where a fees award and you can present to a judge, here's 50 cases and the ranges go from this to that. And the ones that are outliers for the following reason. That can be pretty compelling to judge, and I've had some success with that.
Well, you point out very succinctly, I mean, we have a new volume coming out. It's what the trial lawyers and appellate lawyers in the state of Texas are going to be looking at for the next 2 years. And I think we're going to see some more decisions in light of Yoel. They're going to tell us more about how appellate fees ought to be submitted, certainly how they should be proved. I mean, that was kind of the point of Yoel was, How do you prove it? And we've emphasized already on this show, and I've talked about it other places, that, and you have too, that you really need to be sure and pay close attention to how you prove up your fees, because you can really trip and stumble and make a real big mistake if you don't do it correctly, especially after Yoel and even before Yoel. The signs have been there. You talk about with Oremus, it's like the Supreme Court said, we've been telling y'all about how we really want y'all to do this. Well, I think the same is sort of true with appellate fees. There's some Supreme Court case law from going back to like 2017 where they started saying, well, you know, you didn't do this right. And so it's a take nothing award on the appellate side, which is, in my view, that's pretty awful to have that happen, because appeals, you know, the cost doesn't stop just because the appeal has gone up. The other thing I think that people need to be cognizant of when they're asking for appellate fees is post-judgment fees, because I think those are going to fall under the same basic proof framework as Yoel, because you're not going to know, you know, you won't have your fee statements in hand to be able to show the fact finder in terms of what things have actually cost. And so that's something else to consider. I'm not, Carlos, necessarily advocating for another blank for those here today. We'll have that debate when we get back to the PJC committee.
I think it's a worthy debate.
It certainly is. Well, Carlos, thank you so much for coming on. I think we've reached a good point to conclude for the day, and it's just been a pleasure to have you and hear your perspective. We certainly would like to have more trial lawyers on the show, so maybe we'll start something here. We'll get folks, maybe some who even really disagree with us about the value of appellate counsel. We're happy to have those debates.
Well, I'll see if I can find someone for you.
Do you have, we always like to have our guests kind of wrap up with a tip or a war story. Did you have something that you would be interested in sharing with our listeners before we wrap up for today?
No, I don't think so. I think that we've covered a lot of ground, and I appreciate you having me on. And, you know, y'all have a great podcast going on, and I appreciate being a part of it.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here.
We've talked a lot on the show about how I'm a sole practitioner and have been for a couple of years now, after kind of meandering my way through different firm settings and practices. And I need to have full disclosure for everybody who listens that that's changing. I'll be joining Butler Snow here in Austin to practice with, and I promise you all, this is a complete coincidence, 3 former guests on the show. My good friend, Scott Field, former justice on the Third Court of Appeals. The practice group leader is Amanda Taylor, who was also on the show to talk about TCPA stuff. And our associate in the office is Marshall Bowen. And so that's going to be a big change for me. And I wanted to disclose that because, you know, at some point I'm going to stop talking about being a sole practitioner and start talking about what it's like to be in a dedicated appellate practice group. It'll be kind of like a boutique within a large firm. So I'm really looking forward to that. So just everybody, that change is coming. I just appreciate all the support that I've gotten. And it's been great doing what I've done for the last 15 years on my own, but the time had come to make this change. And I had an opportunity that, you know, to work with that group, and I just couldn't pass it up.
Congratulations. It's a great group.
Yep, it is.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please send us an email at hosts@techsapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.